Thanks, Pemavedra. By way of confession, I had to go into town this afternoon and do a few things, and it got a bit busy and a bit complicated. So when I wrote this talk, I was quite fired up. So I was sort of looking at it. And I was speaking with Pemadaka in the kitchen this morning, and he was saying, you know, what's the talk about? And whenever Pemadaka asked me that before a talk, I was doing an imitation of how my talk's going to be, which is, you know, "You pasty little pommy." And so he says, Pemadaka says, "Oh, it's the usual then." And I said, and then I thought about it, I said, "Yeah, well, I've only got one talk." And I thought about it, I thought it's true actually, it's like Windows, you know, so you said, like, you have Windows 93.2, and then Windows 95.3.1, and then Windows 3.11, and then Windows. So I think I'm up to about 6. I think so. So also, I've also here actually got one poem. Yes, you know, a little bit like the Spice Girls. Only have one song ready. But anyway, we'll see how we get on. Basically, the talk is really to do about reflection on the altar, actually, and the FWBR. I've coming to the end of my phase here at Pamaloka. As Pemavedra pointed out, this is my last retreat at Pamaloka as a full ordination team member. Although looking to the future, I will be on retreat with the Pamakula from time to time, you know, helping out in whatever capacity I can make myself useful. But you know, this phase for me represents the end of 5 years at Pamaloka, you know, coming from Australia and spending 5 years in England at Pamaloka and working here with the ordination team. It also represents a 22-year phase of working in a particular way within the FWBO. So for 22 years, since really I first left New Zealand 22 years ago, I've been working one way or another in this sort of way with the FWBO. And it represents the end of a 31-year phase of actively pursuing Dharma. Or 31 years ago, I was just trying to work out truth, love and reality. And for 27 of those 31 years, I've considered myself a Buddhist. So, coming to the end of my time here at Pamaloka, I've been reflecting quite a lot on what I've gained over the years and what I've done over the years, and I've been reflecting quite a lot on the order and the FWBO. And about a month ago, I was fortunate enough to attend a reunion retreat held at Il Convento di Santa Croce in Tuscany, Italy. And for a number of years, between 1981 and 86, there were three-month ordination retreats held annually in Tuscany at this old convent. It's a 17th-century Benedictine monastery put out of business by Napoleon in 1812, which then became a private estate, and in the 70s was bought by an Englishman called Adam Pollock, who Badger Katie knew, and we used to rent the place in the autumn between 1981 and 1986, and then we used to do ordination retreats there. So there was a reunion there last month. The reunion ran over a month. Ratna Prabhu went out for about 10 days, and I went out for 10 days, different times. And of the 102 men who'd been ordained at Il Convento, quite a number of them came at various times while on this retreat. So it was an opportunity to meet up with men ordained at that particular time in the movement between 1981 and 86 as a time to reflect on life, as a time to reflect on the order and also the universe. And I found the structure of the retreat was very good because I was able to just do the morning meditation, the evening puja, and have plenty of time just to sit around this beautiful old convent in Italy. I really love Italy. And just absorb what's gone on, really. So I was able to absorb my involvement, the consequences of having been involved with Buddhism and the Western Buddhist order, really for the greater part of my life. I had quite a lot of time to wander around the old stone convent, weighing up and contemplating what I'd done during my life. With this, it has to be said, rather anarchic network of people and friendship in the context of Buddhist practice, the Western Buddhist order. I was also concerned to establish what I found to be true for myself concerning the Dharma. So I was concerned to work out what I'd found to be true for myself, as opposed to what I had heard or read from other people, or what I imagined might be true due to wishful thinking. So repeatedly, as I sort of sifted through it all, repeatedly my contemplations came back to the first two verses of the Dhammapada as being the epicenter of spiritual endeavour, as being the epicenter of the spiritual life. So Sangharaksha's translation of the first two verses of the Dhammapada run as follows. Chapter 1, section pairs. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox drawing the cart. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. So these are the first two verses of the Dhammapada. Actions have consequences. This is an observable fact. I think it's one of the things Dada Rinpoche once said of the children leaving the school when he was asked if he had any hopes for what they learned. He said, if they've learned that actions have consequences, then he felt he'd been able to pass something valuable on to them. And certainly it seems to me the fact that actions have consequences is the sort of irreducible fact of the spiritual life. Whatever your philosophical system is, your actions are having some consequences. Even if you think actions don't have consequences, they're still having consequences. And even if you do nothing, doing nothing still has a consequence. So actions have consequences. And, I can observe this, I can see this. I've been around long enough to know that. Earlier in the year, I was in New Zealand and I went for a drive with my parents, who live up in the north of the South Island, and we went up to this place called Farewell Spit, which is not quite what it sounds like. It's a big sandbar shaped like a new moon. It's about 40 kilometres long. It comes off the end of the South Island of New Zealand, and it's a big nature sanctuary, so you can drive up there and have a cup of tea, and just look out, and you've got the binoculars you put, 50 cents into it, and all this sort of stuff, and you can look at the sea and all the rest of it. So I took my parents up there, and on the way up to Farewell Spit, we drove through this place called Tarkika. And Tarkika was where, when I was 18, which was nearly 30 years ago, my friends and I bought 500 acres of land and set up a commune. And we weren't the only ones. Lots of people bought into this area and set up communes. In New Zealand at the time, there was quite a lot of idealism. The government was even putting money into, backing people, to move into communes. They were trying to go a bit the way of kibbutz, I think, like the Israelis. But be that as it may, there is quite a strong alternative sort of flavour to aspects of New Zealand lifestyle. And it was interesting going back to this township of Tarkika, because when I was there 30 years ago, it really was a two-horse town. It was white Anglo-Saxon Protestant dairy farming town. It was unimaginative. It was uncultured. It was dead. And it was run by the chairman of the local council and his mates. It was gerrymandering on a grand scale within the local community. There was nothing happening there. And when I went back this year, it's quite a thriving little community. There's a lot of people there, and there's art shops and museums and a whole food restaurant and whole food shops. And there's a whole culture there. It's a direct result of what we did 30 years ago. If we hadn't have done that, that wouldn't be there. And it has affected a complete transformation on that small society. And, it gave me food for thought, because I thought, what we're doing in the FWBR is the same thing, but I think it's on such a large scale, the translation of Buddhism into the history and culture of a civilization, that it's maybe several hundred years before one really sees the tangible results. I think, what I was seeing, when I went back to Tarkika at Christmas, was the microcosmic aspect of social change. It was just a small town that had been changed by ideas and people doing things. So, you know, obviously, you know, what we're doing in the FWPO is on a much larger, much more coherent and sophisticated level, and will have much larger effect. But it may not be obvious in the same sort of way for a number of years, or a number of centuries even. When I first went to London in 1981 as a rather innocent young New Zealander, I knew all the order members. Only about 100 order members in those days. It was around the LBC. It was the Croydon lot who were. You even knew who they were. You could see an order member and identify them. And the order was quite small. We didn't own anything. I mean, the movement didn't have two pennies to rub together. I think we were working with an FBS in 1981, bailing the London Buddhist Centre out of bankruptcy, as far as I can remember, under the guidance of the then Bob Jones, who's now Badricated. And you can see, you know, the movement's grown, it's flourished. There's retreat centres, you know, there's a network of centres all around the world. There's an ordination system, you know, there's a coherent system of practice and all the rest of it. You know, the movement has grown and flourished. And, you know, and that's just visible in the time I've been around. And looking back over my own life, based on, you know, volitional interest in seeking reality, truth and love, from a young age I had this problem. You know, I couldn't see the point of living, because you're going to die at the end of it. And it seemed to me pretty stupid to go about the business of, you know, not having a job and going to university and all the rest of it if you're just going to die. And you'd never work out why you were alive in the first place. So I sort of worked it back that I had to work out why I was alive in the first place before I could do anything else. And I thought for a while that everybody knew something that I didn't. I thought everybody was in on a secret. And it took me years before I realised they just didn't think about it. They just seemed to be myopic. You know, they just didn't really seem to be aware of impermanence. But anyway, I set off on this quest, you know, to seek reality, truth and love. And I've travelled an inward and outward journey from New Zealand in 1979 as a somewhat limited, reckless and existentially desperate young man. To a middle-aged man standing where I am now. And that's effectively been the journey. But the question arises, well, what does it mean to be standing in this place here at Pamaloka, giving a talk in the lounge on a summer's evening, you know, set against the beautiful and tranquil backdrop of the Pamaloka Gardens? When I wrote that, I took a pun that it wasn't going to be raining. So I'm a member of the Western Buddhist Order, of the ordination team, of the Pamukula. And I was thinking, well, you know, what does it mean? Because, you know, change must have taken place during that time. So the most immediately obvious thing that comes to mind has been the development of an ethical sensitivity based in a sense of metta, of empathy, and at times of delight. So the development of quite a finely tuned sense of what distinguishes right from wrong, of what distinguishes the skillful from the unskillful, of the wholesome from the wholesome. And this is a sensitivity that has distilled from a coherent practice of meditation, Dharma study, devotional ritual and altruistic activity. And all this has been embraced within the context of spiritual friendship. And this sense of the ethical has distilled at times despite myself, and despite the stupidity of my own sufferings and ignorance. And that's one of the things, you know, the functions of the spiritual community is you can sort of hook on and ride along. But I think this ethical sense is very, very important. You know, for me it is anyway, because I can remember a time years ago when, you know, I knew murder was wrong, but I really wasn't sure what was right and wrong. I really just didn't know. And As I've become more sensitive towards ethics, and it has taken some time, I've also seen that an ethical sensibility begins to bring your life under some sort of creative control. I think before you have a coherent system of ethics or a coherent ethical sensibility, you're basically out of control, really. You're sort of bouncing around, you know, reactively. or you're tumbling through the universe. You're just going with whatever current takes you whichever way. And I find that, you know, looking back on it, it's, to be in that state, or to imagine myself being in that state again, it's quite scary, actually. But fortunately, you know, one of the things I have gained from my years of involvement with the movement is this ethical sensibility. So I see that as being, you know, the first thing, really, the first thing that comes to my mind, and maybe one of the most immediate and important things. I think one of the significant features of having lived in men's community and been involved in FWBO activities for 22 years is that the ship of my spiritual life has stayed upright and basically pointing in the right direction. Yeah, there's no question in my mind that without these supportive conditions, i.e. the conditions I found in the FWBO, my spiritual life would have foundered on any number of reefs and sandbars. The FWBO provides a network of friendship and conditions supportive of one's spiritual endeavour. That's quite clear to me looking back. Now, it may not be perfect. In fact, I'd go further than that. I'd say it's definitely not perfect. People can be an absolute pain in the butt, myself included. There's no two ways about that. But measured from one year to the next, one decade to another, you know, through my association with these people, I have incrementally been able to transform myself into something resembling a human being, you know, a human being that actually is practicing Dharma. And that's significant. That is significant. You know, when one considers the importance of volition in terms of determining, you know, the outcome of you know, one's future behaviours and actions, you know, hanging in with a spiritual community is quite a strong volitional wish. You know, it's a strong positive volition. Just the fact that one, you know, wants to do that at all. Because all the things that you can do in this world, the freedoms, in inverted commas, that we have available to us. And, you know, what I chose to do was hang in, with the spiritual community. And I can begin to see that, you know, in my old age. No, my old age, my middle age, sorry. Let's not get ahead of myself. In my middle age as being a positive, heavy karma. The other main area, and this is associated with ethics, that's come out of the movement for me, is the development of culture. Now, initially, when I came along to the FWBO, I thought that Bhante's teaching on culture was his weak point. I thought, he's English, and he's a bit that way, you know. I thought, well, you know, that's the English. Just get on with the real stuff, you know, the meditation and the rest of it. And I'll tell you this story. It's just coming to my mind. It's really funny. I remember being on my first Tuscany in 1981, and I didn't get ordained, by the way, because I wasn't ready. But anyway, I was having a bit of a hard time of it, and I've always written, you know, poetry. I've always worked on my one poem ever since I was about eight. And, I was sort of browsing around the library at Il Convento, the monastery at Il Convento. It's got this brilliant library. It's all, you know, all about the Renaissance, and it's got lots of, you know, the poets of, you know, the great poets through the ages and all that, all in this library, lots of art, architecture, the Etruscans, the popes, you know, Florentian and all the rest of it. So sort of nosing around there, and I was up in my room one day, and Kay Maloka came up, and he saw, you know, I was a bit interested in Byron, you know, Byron and Shelley. But I wasn't sort of going to be that interested, you know, because as far as I was concerned, they, you know, a bunch of black-livered, lace-wearing pommy pufters. And I wasn't... You so see, you could say, get a glimmer of why I wasn't being ordained. But anyway, I never forget. This is skillful means. This is skillful means. And, came like I said, he said, yeah, I see what you mean. He said, mind you, you know, Lord Byron was interesting. And I said, what is that? And he says, he said he had a stretch stagecoach pulled by six horses. He said, with a bar and a double bed in the back. And I was like,
Oh yeah. And actually, he gives me a history of Lord Byron, you know, describing his escapades, not much about his poetry, but his escapades around Europe, you know, with a stretched stagecoach and pulled by these horses with the double bed and the bar in the back. And of course, this sort of unravelled into an interest in, you know, into the romantic poets and Shelley and all the rest of it. And then, you know, while I was at Tuscany, I was sort of plotting Shelley's travels around Italy, you know, with all the maps and books in the library and all that. And it sort of opened up the whole world of that particular sort of era, you know, of English poets. But that was, you know, that was Kamalaka introducing me to culture, but, you know, via the use of skillful means. But Sangharakshita, basically, Sangharakshita says that for most people, their first communication with the spiritual is likely to be through the medium of cultural activity. So this is to say, one's first experience of joy, of tranquility or rapture, one's first experience of emotional exuberance or fullness of heart is likely to be through the medium of cultural activity. If one is moved by a superb piece of writing, or one is moved by music or visual art, or just moved by that which pertains to beauty, it may even be nature, to truth. If one is moved by that which uplifts one's heart and finer sensibilities. And for most of us, you know, this is where we actually touch the spiritual. If you look at the spiral path, you know, joy is joy, tranquility is tranquility. You know, fullness of heart is fullness of heart, rapture is rapture. You know, it doesn't matter whether you read it. You come across a, you know, reading you know, a piece of D.H. Lawrence or, you know, some other modern novelist, or listening, you know, to a piece of classical music or whatever it is. You know, to have that experience is to have that experience. I remember when I was working in Melbourne, you know, on the centre there, and sometimes you just get a bit dry. And there was one cinema called Track Cinema that used to run a lot of the opera films, and they had this huge stereo system. You know, you'd go there, and there'd be about four of you in the theatre. I never worked out how they made any money, but anyway, they used to make the government sponsor them. But they used to, I remember going to see La Boheme once, and by about the third aria, you know, I could just feel my heart just sort of be alive, as it were, just bursting forth. And you know, before that, I'd been sort of quite dry. You know, my meditation practice wasn't really up to much. So, you know, Sangharakshita has observed, you know, the fact that, you know, the medium of cultural activities is an effective way to bridge between the mundane and the spiritual. So I think this is a big factor for me in the FWBO, is the amount of colour and emotional richness and life and cultural education that, you know, I've received just by my association with people like Kamalaka, sort of bumbling around as, you know, with everyone else. When I left New Zealand, I was fairly naive. I was a fairly young man. I was definitely a bit uncultured. I think Bante referred to me once as a bit of a rough diamond. So, my journey through the FWBO, it's opened up to me travel. That's the first thing. You know, having to travel to England, you know, to get hook up with the FWBO. And the FWBO is a great place to travel in. You know, wherever you go, you usually see the best. FWBO people on the whole are fairly culturally tuned up, and they're in the know in the different countries. They're in the know. You know, in their area, they'll know the places to go, and they'll have the connections. So you go along as a mitra, you know, and you're sort of welcomed into the fold, as it were, and then people show the place off to you. So it's a great way to travel. It's much better than being a tourist, and it's much better than trying to, you know, make your way around England or Italy or the United States on a guidebook. I say it again, I don't understand why more young order members, you know, aren't travelling about the movement much more than they do. I mean, yeah, it's a great opportunity. And it's so enriching. You know, just being able to go to Italy in the context of those retreats and go to Florence and Siena and have this library and go down to Rome and just understand, you know, a lot more about, you know, the Roman Empire's relationship to, you know, to the Greeks, and then also, you know, the Florentine Renaissance, the effect that had on Europe and why it was Renaissance and all the rest of it. You know, it's very interesting, very enriching. So, you know, there's a knock-on effect of that is history, art, and architecture, Western culture. I particularly like architecture, you know, being a builder. And, you know, Florence in particular was very interesting. There's some interesting pieces of architecture there dating back to the Renaissance period. And also, you know, some you know, sculpture and, you know, casting in bronze and various metals and things like that, which quite interested me. History, I'm not such a great one on the visual arts. I quite like that, but I wouldn't go out of my way, you know, to have a look at the exhibition. And that's what I'm really interested. I'd rather go and have a cup of coffee and watch the world go by. But I am very interested in history. History is one of my consuming interests. And particularly through Buddhism, you know, studying the history of Buddhism, you know, the movements of Buddhism, the development of the doctrines and all the rest of it, and also being able to move around the world in various ways, has been incredibly enriching. You know, I've visited places of outstanding natural beauty. You know, Finland, for example. If you go to Finland, you know, you get spoiled rotten by the Finns and the Estonians. So, you know, you end up staying at Abbaloka, which is this retreat centre on the edge of this great big lake, and it's got a wood-fired sauna, and you can sauna and swim in this beautiful lake, and there's forests. And it's a very good place to meditate. And the Finns are all mad, which suits me just fine. The Estonians, on the other hand, are much more cultured. But Tallinn's a beautiful city, and the Estonians spoil me as well. So I do quite well, you know, out of travelling around. It's very enriching. You know, Il Convento is a beautiful building. It's built out of stone, sandstone, and it is, as you would imagine, an old sort of medieval monastery or late medieval monastery. It's got a sort of big courtyard with a cloister. And it's three sides of 2 stories high with little cells up above. And then there's a loggia that's open on both sides with a sort of covered roof. And then there's a well in the middle of this cloister, a sort of courtyard. And then there's a big wing, you know, with lots of cells and rooms. And it's all got vaulted, arched ceilings. And it's all built out of stone and tiles. And it's got a very particular atmosphere. And, you know, there's this terrace with a stone lion on it. The Lion Terrace is called, and you can stand there at sunset and look out over the Mediterranean, and you can see Elba on a clear day, the island of Elba. And, you know, one's memory is of lots of sunsets, lots of light. It's very bright, very beautiful place, very atmospheric. Yeah, most Italians wouldn't get an opportunity to live in a place like that. But, you know, there we are, just sort of dropping into a place like that for, you know, 3 or 4 months and living there. Cuyoloca, you know, living in a mountain desert environment in Spain. Pamelica, living here at Pamelica. Pamelica is quite an extraordinary place. I mean, how many English people get the opportunity to live in an English manor house for 5 years, 5 acres of garden, with a gardener and a cook? Well, most people just don't. It's as simple as that. Here we all are. So it's very enriching being in there, travelling around, moving around the FWO. Then the Sakavti, you know, living down in London in an old Victorian fire station, an old converted Victorian fire station, in the middle of Bethnal Green, mate. You know. And that's an education in itself, particularly if you come from overseas. And then there's the people, you know, I've got to know a very wide range of people in the FWO, and I can't do them all justice. It's just a few names I noted down here. Dharma Mudra. Those of you who don't know Dharma Mudra, he's an order member of about 15 years standing. He lives out in Aslacton, which is country Norfolk. And he was a boxer in the east end of London. He did about 32 bouts, a light heavyweight. I think he lost 2 bouts in his time. He's definitely a Londoner, and he's definitely, you know, South Londoner. He's about as wide as they come. And he's got this penchant for people dying in his arms. I don't know what it is. I think that seven people have died in his arms. He's quite an interesting character. He's also a sculptor. He's the guy who sculpted Bante's head. And he's this incredible mix. And he's got the boxer's nose. And he's this incredible mix of qualities. I mean, there's something that is sort of fundamentally likeable about the character. He's just a thoroughly sort of interesting character.
The Sabuti. Sabuti was the son of the head of the Royal Navy for Nigeria. His father was an aide to Lord Mountbatten in the war, sent to a private school, trained up to run an empire. Sabuti is a very, very interesting character. There's a lot could be said about Sabuti. There's Arloka, Arloka the artist, who lives in Norwich. I don't know how you would describe Arloka. I think he's a very important artist. He's a bridge between traditional Indo-Tibetan iconography and a Western tradition. I think he's more important than just the movement, the WBO. But that remains to be seen. He looks like something that the cats drag backwards out of a gutter, dressed in leathers, and has these hilarious deadpan commentaries on life. I was around there building it. I'll just tell you one. I might get too much trouble for telling one. But there's his partner, Pamajoti, is Spanish autumn member. She had there's all these women. I've come to the conclusion that the place where they live is one of the communication centres for the Sahara world when I was working there. But Pamajoti had all these women autumns around, and I think there were a few mitras as well, and they were really going for it around the table. And Arloka was standing out there, he's got this long hair, these rings, standing out there at the backyard like this, and I stand next to him, he says, I think they're going to lay an egg in a minute. he's full of these observations of life. He seems to have this way of just slicing through to the reality of the situation. And then I just wrote down one of my other mates, Zatchera, who turned up to Sheffield Buddha Centre in a Lotus sports car, with a suit and briefcase. He's a businessman. He rocks in the door. He's also one of England's, top rock climbers in his day as well. He's quite an interesting character as well. He's a very successful, worldly man, lives with his family in Sheffield. A very happy wife and children. So there's just all these characters. That's the other thing to do with the cultural richness. It's just the friendship. And I've put down here Buddhadasa. Buddhadasa is a Welshman. He's one of the very early order members. I think he's a Kalyana Mitra de Pamavadra, actually. He's a funny old fella in some respects. He was in the English Tank Corps when he was younger. They offered him a job. He wanted to get out, so they offered him a job in the SAS artillery, but he wouldn't take it. Trained up as an interior designer, then had the perfect job designing the interior of pubs. And he's on his way to get a job as a croupier when somebody smacked into his car and spun it around, so he never made the appointment. Then he met Bante 2 days later. Mm-hmm. And where Buddhadasa and I cemented our friendship was on the Beely Ridge in the South Island of New Zealand. There's a ridge traverse, Avalanche Lyle Beely. It's about 5,000 foot. We're sitting on this ridge, on a particular section of the ridge, about 300 yards long. The only way you can get along it is you sit on it with your legs either side of the ridge, because you've got about 400 or 500 foot drop either side, a bit like that. And then you sort of hop along the ridge like you're on a saddle. It's easier if it's got snow on it. It was summer, so it was sort of rock. That's the only way you can really get along it. And we ended up, we're on this ridge having an argument about whether or not to take a photo, because I wanted to take a photo and he didn't. And anyway, we didn't take the photo. I think that's where we cemented our friendship. And and all this took place in the sparse backdrop of these snow and ice covered mountains. So I've developed all sorts of friendships. Leaving Pamaloka, obviously, one of the biggest losses for me will be the Order Chapter. Just will not be able to replace the Ordination Team Order Chapter. I've also developed my appreciation of music. And also, by association, my enjoyment and appreciation of nature. I've been up to the northwest highlands of Scotland a few times with my good friend Manju Siddha. There's the mountains of South Island with Buddhadasa, and also living at Pamaloka. I think I've become much more of a country boy living at Pamaloka. I don't like the city so much anymore. So I can say that my life has been and is immeasurably enriched as a result of life in the Sangha. It's just a fact.
I don't know, you know, where it would have been if I was just left to my own devices. But, you know, there is a sort of emphasis on culture and the movement, and it does have its effect. So, from experiences being preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind, a positive volition based in matter, an aspiration to follow the teaching of the Buddha, if acted upon in the FWBO, will have a creative and enriching effect upon one's life, developing a coherent basis for meditation. I mean, this is the thing, you know, all this ethics and culture, it's all very well. But what you can do is, you know, you can take the energy, you can take the sort of richness and the brightness of it all, and then start to channel it. And the next obvious thing is, you know, meditation. Certainly for me, in terms of my own career and life within the order, you know, meditation is very important. And I must confess that when I first came along to the FWBO in 1989, in terms of preference, I didn't have much desire to be a part of the order in terms of people. As far as I was concerned, people were something you had to put up with till you got enlightened, and then you could sort of, you didn't have to worry about them anymore. And I certainly couldn't understand, you know, why Bhante had ordained so many, you know, dimwits. I think there's a little thing to do with arrogance in there somewhere. But, had to be sort of. So I didn't really want to be, I wasn't that fussed about, you know, being part of the order. I certainly didn't, so wasn't wildly attracted by the people in the order. But I did want a sadhana practice. So I saw that I had to get ordained in order to get a sadhana practice. So yeah, getting ordained is an obstacle that I sort of had to overcome, really, so that I could get my sadhana practice and then I'm good. But one of the early notable features of the FWBO complex and system of practice for me was that I had spiritual experience of my own. And that was very important to me. It was not as if I was a spectator for someone else's spiritual growth and development. By doing what Bhante told me to in terms of practice, you know, I had spiritual experience. And that suited me just fine. You know, that's what I was after. I could see no point in involving myself with the Buddhist tradition if I didn't have any spiritual experience. No point at all. I had no interest whatsoever in dressing up like a Tibetan or a little Buddhist, walking around with a bald head and all the rest of it. You know, I mean, I had a job of work to do, and the FWBO basically had to deliver the goods. That was my attitude. And it did. Bhante's fourfold system of meditation suited me very well. So, by way of refreshing your memories, Bhante's fourfold system of meditation is first integration, involves integration, especially using the mindfulness of breathing. And then there's positive emotion, the development of positive emotion, especially using the metta bhavana. Then there's spiritual death, especially the six element practice, and then spiritual rebirth, visualization practice. So it goes integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, and spiritual rebirth. So, I used to do the metta and the mindfulness, and then I used to do the Padmasambhava, the prostration practice, six element practice, and then from 1981, where at the Tuscany retreat where I didn't get ordained, I did come away with the Amitabha visualization practice. So my meditation career within the movement sort of encompasses three main periods. First, I've got it written down. First, I was a dhyana bunny. So I used to chase dhyana. I was really like big on getting into dhyana. So I used to do all sorts of things. I'd sit absolutely still for 2 hours, and I'd put an alarm clock wrapped in a big pile of pillars in the cupboard so I couldn't hear it ticking. And then I'd set the alarm for 2 hours, and I'd just sit still until the alarm rang. This is when I was in my 20s. And I would. I'd just sit there. But I always found after about an hour and a half, an hour and 40 minutes, I'd usually start getting into dhyana. And then I started pursuing dhyana. I found solitary retreats were very good. But I said, some people find solitary retreats very useful. So I thought, off I go, why not a solitary retreat? And I found there, and I started to get into much deeper levels of dhyana. So this was very good. And the men's communities quite often, the regular meditation practice. So
you know, I become a Dhyana bunny and went through all the stages of a Dhyana bunny. You first start getting into Dhyana and you know, you're so refined, you're so high, you know. Come to breakfast and someone bangs a peanut butter jar and you immediately, you know, want to kill them. You know, I mean, they're just so insensitive, they're just so gross. You know, and here am I, so refined. Obviously elevated, and they can't even see it. And just doing all this stuff to chase Dhyana, you know, like, worried that, you know, some of the other mitras might be experiencing more jhana than me. Back to the mat. So that was all quite interesting. It was, yeah, it's quite good fun, really. But then I became more interested in insight practice. You know, slowly began to dawn on me that if you wanted to you know, understand the Buddha's teaching, you had to develop much more in the way of insight. And all during this phase, I had this sort of great wrestling match going on with conditioned co-production, because the way my logic worked was, you know, all the people that I respected, you know, Sangharakshita, the monk Gnanavera, you know, the Buddha, they were the people I respected, basically. But they said that, yeah, you need to understand conditioned co-production in order to understand the Buddha's teaching. So I thought, right, you know, I understand conditioned co-production. So I started boring into conditioned co-production. But unfortunately, the Bhikkhu Gnanavera had a slightly different interpretation than the traditional three-life interpretation which Bhante upheld. And then I thought, well, one of them's right and one of them's wrong. Whoever's wrong has got it all wrong, because their basis would be wrong. So then I had to sort of work out the whole thing for myself so I could understand it. Because if I got it wrong, then like my chances of getting enlightened were finished, you see. So it was very loaded. There's a lot on it. And whenever I used to go and talk to Bhante about it, you know, he used to have this big red chair up in Pema Bhante's room, and he'd sit in his chair, come in muddy. And I'd ask him this big convoluted sort of question on conditioned co-production. Yeah? And he'd just go, and you just look out the window. It changed the subject. And I was very grateful to him for this, actually. In years to come, I was very grateful to him, because he just left me to work it out for myself. Mm. And I think this is something, it's something I've picked up in the movement a bit lately, that I just wanted to say a word about this tonight, just from my experience. That you can't understand insight if it's handed to you on a plate. You know, at some point you have to work the Buddha's teaching out for yourself. And that means making it your business to go and find out what it's all about and make it your business to understand it. You can't have it handed. As soon as it's handed to you on a plate, it's already too late. You know, you need that volitional intensity, you know, to go and find it. And you've got to dig yourself with your own shovel. And you've got to do, you know, you've got to do the hard yards and all the spade work yourself and the thinking. I remember going for a walk with Bhante once, and he's saying to me, you know, the reason he's so clear is because he had to work it all out for himself. And I think ultimately all of us, you know, if you're going to understand, you've got to work it out for yourself. And so I think in a way, actually, what Bhante did, you know, was give me a blessing, really. He wouldn't have it. He just let me work it out for myself. And, I was very appreciative of that. So I became more interested in insight practice, you know, this six-element meditation practice, you know, prostration, going for refuge practice, you know, contemplation of the Nidanas, contemplation of the Four Noble Truths, and traditional categories of the Dharma, the three Lakshanas, like these first two verses of Dhammapada, stuff like that. And then eventually, you know, that developed into, I finally began working more seriously on my mind. You know, the penny started to drop. That, well, actually, you know, I couldn't really take this insight practice seriously if I wasn't doing something about my mental states. Because while I was a good meditator, I thought, oh, well, I don't have to worry about, you know, my mental states, my ethics particularly. I'll just carry on meditating and living a spiritual life. And it's a sort of great trail of wreckage and unskillfulness behind me. And I think, you know, at a certain point, you have to actually start getting to work on your mental states, which come into, you know, the mind precepts in terms of the 10 precepts that you take off your precept at your time of ordination. But the question arises, the question arose in my mind, well, what has meditation done, within the FWBO system of meditation, what has meditation done over the years? Well, I think the first thing, and I'm lifting this from Bhante, meditation has provided a sheet anchor for my spiritual life. A sheet anchor is defined as being the heavy anchor carried on a sailing ship for use of stabilizing the ship in serious heavy conditions. So meditation actually, puts ballast in the keel of your spiritual life. It's a sheet anchor, it's a stabilizing effect. So first, there's metta and mindfulness, which deals with integration and positive emotion. So this provides a basis for the development of samatha, of awareness of positive emotion, and it lays the cognitive and emotional foundation for sati, for mindfulness. And mindfulness is the basis of the emergent true individual. It's not bliss, it's mindfulness. This is very important. If you start really seriously beginning to contemplate impermanence, if you don't have enough samatha, you just get depressed. You can look at impermanence two ways. You can either see a flower is all the more beautiful for its fragility and impermanence, or you can just see a flower as affirming, everything's doomed, it's hopeless, everything's going to go out of existence, everything fades and withers, including myself. And so you need the samatha, you need the positive emotional buoyancy and the lucidity of mind to be able to clearly deal with insight practices. Otherwise, you're going to be on a hiding to nothing. And from this arises, the emergent true individual. So the six element practice, contemplation of the nidana chain, going for refuge and prostration practice. These are all integral elements of insight practice within Bhante's system of meditation. And these practices, in principle, represent insight into impermanence, insight into conditionality. And they are the principal formulation of the Buddha's enlightenment experience. Conditionality is the principal and unique formulation of the Buddha's enlightenment experience. So that with the more insight-based meditation practices, one begins to unravel one's web of ignorance. Not by reflecting abstractly about the nature of existence, but by beginning to observe for oneself the nature of phenomenal existence, albeit with the help of the Buddha's teaching. Now, in this respect, as far as I'm concerned, and I haven't got time to elaborate my argument here, but I'm happy to discuss it. As far as I'm concerned, based on experience, Sangharakshita is outstanding amongst Buddhist teachers for his clarity and precision of thought, for his presentation of the Dharma. And for this, I am exceedingly grateful to the man. I've been in a position to view other Buddhists, and I'm extremely grateful that I've got Sangharakshita as a teacher. So this is spiritual death. Not Sangharakshita as a teacher. Well, it is actually. It's an aspect of it. Insight into impermanence, into conditionality, six element practice, contemplation of the Nidana chain. Spiritual death, really. It's as if one dissects oneself within the controlled environment of a controlled breakdown. And you need to know, who your spiritual friends are when you start playing around with this stuff. But then finally, there is sadhana, which is spiritual rebirth. Now, sadhana is visualization and mantra recitation meditation practice. And it's practice within the context of the order, of the Western Buddhist order. It's practice within a coherent interrelationship of Kalyana Mitrata, of spiritual friendship and devotion toward our teachers. It's practice within a context of reverence towards the teachings and traditions of our particular school of Buddhism. So that's the context for sadhana. And now without that context, sadhana is not much use to you. That's my experience. You need that context of spiritual friendship, of devotion, of reverence towards the teachings and traditions. Within this context, if you do it consistently and positively, sadhana will disclose to the individual something of the vitality, will disclose something of the ineffable beauty, of the powerful compassion and the tender love of the heart of emancipation. That's the function of sadhana. One's basis of Kalyana Mitrata, spiritual friendship, of friendship, you know, with the lovely, with the sublime. One's basis of Kalyana Mitrata and sublime devotion to the ideal unveils the radiance and splendor of the Yidam. And this breathes life to the inexpressible wonder of a consciousness possessing spiritual creativity. And you know, if you stop and think about it, it's a wonder that there's anything here at all. You know, if you just sort of stop and think, I mean, the fact that there's anything here at all is amazing. Let alone this, you know, all these beings running around and all this stuff going on and planes flying through the sky and cars. But at the bottom of it all, every single being is able to attain to Buddhahood. And that's the inexpressible wonder of a consciousness possessing spiritual creativity. The fact there's anything here at all. But the bottom line is Buddha consciousness, is the Buddha nature. That's the bottom line. And it's the Yidam, it's the sadhana practice in the context of the spiritual community, in the context of Kalyana Mitrata, in the complete and full sense, that actually, you know, opens one's heart, you know, to, you know, the truth of reality. So that one discovers something of the unimaginable treasury of the Bodhisattva path. So this is, you know, this is Bhante's system of meditation. So this discovery is further amplified and integrated through one's altruistic activity, and also through practices such as pujas, festival and worship. And all of these are integral aspects of FWBO practice. So this aspect of Bhante's system of meditation is interesting. Well, it's interesting to me because it constellates around the principle of speech, the principle of communication. Now, if you think about it, sadhana, the meditation practice, you know, takes place in the context, you know, of a lot of communication, a lot of discussion. You know, the whole thing of sorting out friendship and sorting out views and ideas and principles and why one's doing it and why it works and all the rest of it. It's a lot of it is communicated esoterically. It's communicated, you know, by word of mouth, you know, teacher to disciple. So it's tied up with the principle of communication, and this is quite an interesting point. In his book, The Three Jewels, Bhante speaks of enlightenment as a sovereign realm. And I think this is very apt in many respects. At the level of the Sambhogakaya, the deity actually turns up, as it were, and one experiences the higher state of consciousness as being intensely personal. And one's higher spiritual experiences, you know, by definition, by experience, are intensely personal. And people say, you know, well, why aren't more order members talking about this spiritual experience? You know, I mean, David Smith's written a book. Why aren't more people being more open about this? Well, the reason is that if it is strong spiritual experience, it is intensely personal. It's very difficult to communicate. You can only really communicate it within a context. And that context has to be a context of communication, which means there has to be mutual receptivity. And that's not such an easy matter. So at the level of the Sambhogakaya, the deity actually turns up. One experiences the higher state of consciousness as being intensely personal. So bear in mind, it is human beings that gain enlightenment, not abstract principles. It's us as human beings that gain enlightenment. So, you know, at the higher levels of spiritual reality, we as human beings have an intensely personal experience of the wonderful nature of Buddha mind, in communication with the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, within a context of Sangha and of communication. This is how it works. Of the brotherhood of hearers of the richly endowed one, the Buddha. And, you know, I mean, don't know why, but that's how it is. You know, it's another one of the wonders, if you like, of, you know, spiritual creativity. So in respect of this communication,
It can be difficult to work out which came first, the chicken or the egg, you know, the Sangha or the Sadhana, the Sadhana or the Sangha. It's not, you can't quite sort of, you know, trace the first thread. It's not that simple. It's as if there is no division between the context of practice and those practicing, between oneself and other, between the venerable tradition, the Dharma, the teachers of the past and present, one's guru and the yidam. This is it. One's heart, one's reality is permeated by the same ineffable, unutterable beauty consummated in the heart of the mantra. It's just how it works. And the mantra is a magic dharani, which, you know, is consummated in every cell of the universe. And this all emanates from the heart of the Bodhisattva. And the heart of the Bodhisattva emanates from one's sadhana practice. And one's sadhana practice is given to one by one's spiritual friend. And it's very hard to sort of like pin it down exactly where it comes in. Yeah, this, I think this is where, you know, Bhante introduces this idea of the bodhicitta, the impersonal or the transpersonal. And it is this essential relationship that is the principle, the fundamental source, the root of communication. And this manifests as the Sambhogakaya, the body of mutual delight. So this is one of the wonderful things about Bhante's system of meditation in the Western Buddhist order, spiritual rebirth. And Bhante is the master of understatement. He's absolute master. Yeah, when Bhante talks about mindfulness, I don't think him and I are talking about the thinking about the same thing. Yeah, he's talking about awareness, probably, you know, of reality. You know, if you're truly mindful, you're aware of reality. So he's talking about integration. He's talking about positive emotion. You know, he's talking about positive emotion. He's talking about, you know, joy, rapture, bliss, you know, tranquility. You know, this is positive emotion, not just, you know, feeling good because the sun's out. He's talking about a very powerful quality. And then spiritual death. And I think, you know, the spiritual death is much more far-reaching quite often than we think, particularly if you go to a place like Guhyalaka. And then, of course, spiritual rebirth. You know, the penetrating through the heart of the visualization practice. And here, the thing is, you find out about all this stuff through association with one's spiritual friends, brothers and sisters, in the context of Dharma practice. So the clear instruction of the Buddha remains unsurpassed in guiding one's footsteps along the path, the Dhammapada. And I think it's really significant that this latest translation of the Dhammapada, which Bhante has put out, is a brilliant translation. You know, he's got enough knowledge of the Pali, but a mastery of the English language. So it's a very hard to describe. It's a very good translation. But it's also produced by the movement. You know, it's produced by our own publishing house and various order members designing it and working out the text layout and the cover and all the rest of it. Yeah, so it's a product of the order. It's a product of the FWBO. And I think it's significant. You know, the clear instruction of the Buddha, the unsurpassed clear instruction of the Buddha, in guiding one's footsteps along the path, you know, is presented, you know, symbolically and literally in the Dhammapada, you know, within the movement, arising from the movement. So in relation to all this, section 3 of the Dhammapada, the text says, verse 34, as a fish threshes from side to side when taken from one abode to another and cast on dry land, so the mind throbs and vibrates with the strain as it abandons the domain of Mara. As a fish threshes from side to side when taken from one abode to another and cast on dry land, so the mind throbs and vibrates with the strain as it abandons the domain of Mara. I think we all know about that. I don't have to elaborate on that point. So this verse carries us further in to the development of wisdom within Buddhism. Sure, one aspect of wisdom is prajna, in the sense that it is a pure, unmediated perception of reality. But another aspect of wisdom is the body of wisdom held in common by the spiritually mature. A body of wisdom able to guide one through the vicissitudes of the spiritual life, particularly as one's mind throbs and vibrates with the strain. Because the way it works, or how it actually works, is it's not that ultimately and finally we walk off into the spiritual son of Arochana, you know, our minds fixed in a perpetual state of bliss, the result of one final apocalyptic experience of prajna. Unfortunately, no. We as human beings are all much messier, untidier, and generally more peculiar than this neat schemata. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. So basically, anyway, put it into plain English. There are bits and pieces of us floating about all over the place, powered by a bag of mixed motives, which, if we carry along on long enough in spiritual life, at some point becomes imbued with insight into the nature of things. That's actually how it works. So to be sure, wisdom, prajna, eventually touches every aspect of one's being, illuminating and revitalizing the spiritual faculties within the stream of one's psychophysical energy. But it is not the neat path of a seamless bronze and plaster Buddha image. It's not the neat path of a Buddha image removed from the chthonic depths of the human state, touched with a wand of sterile, humourless and repressed Protestant Puritanism. That's not how the Buddha saints work. Buddha saints are peculiarly human, irritatingly untidy, and profoundly awakened. So in a community such as the FWBO, numbering tens of thousands of unenlightened people rubbing up against each other, things will go bump in the night. If you're in the FWBO in the order and you think things are not going to go bump in the night, you need your head read, because you are extremely naive, not to mention stupid. But worse than this, people will sometimes behave more like praters and asharas, behave more like hell beings or animals than behave like bodhisattvas. Or they may just smile arrogantly and insensitively from their godlike state of comfort. Now, I know all about this, because at various times I have made my own substantial contribution to the underbelly of the order of the FWBO. Now, it's no good clenching our little fists and stamping our feet on the ground because the order is like this. You know, the whole human race is like this. The whole of conditioned existence is like this. You know, and we just have to get on with it. And we just have to be realistic. But on the positive side, in my experience, the spiritual community provides a steady basis of sanity and ethical conduct. And this is really important. It provides a basis of sanity and ethical conduct around which the various aspects of one's personality can form into a single, harmonious, integrated stream of energy. So from the struggles of practicing the Bodhisattva path distills the true individual, the coherent man possessed of insight. Now, it is the elder brothers, I'll repeat that, it is the elder brothers that hold the centre steady in the spiritual community, providing shelter for beings and thereby sustaining the positive conditions necessary for the maintenance and propagation of the Sangha, and ultimately one's entry into the lamp of certainty or the jewelled ornament of liberation. In terms of the wisdom side of things, in terms of the doctrine side of things within the movement, one of the things that attracted me to Sangharakshita in the first instance was his insistence on the importance of the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, in a pure, undilated, undiluted form. And I first became aware of this fact listening to his Noble Eightfold Path lecture series in 1979. It was the Four Noble Truths straight down the line. Noble Eightfold, Four Noble Truths, Noble Eightfold Path, straight up the middle of the channel, no messing. And I thought, very good. Yeah, this is the man for me. I was also pleased to find in the Survey of Buddhism Bhante's insistence on the primacy of the doctrine of conditioned co-production and the Four Noble Truths as representing the briefest synthesis of the entire doctrines of Buddhism, upon which rest all later philosophical and doctrinal developments of Buddhism. In effect, all methods of practice. And my sense of it was, and is, that Sangharakshita is standing in the heart of the Dharma. And certainly, my observation of him over,
20, 25 years, is that it is toward the three jewels of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha that he has led people, and where he has ultimately encouraged people to put down their roots. And I think, you know, that's one of the outstanding features of him as a teacher, you know, is his spiritual integrity. So through his teaching, it is the very clear perception of impermanence, you know, of anicca, anatta, and dukkha, the clear comprehension of shunyata, that constitutes the principal doctrines and wisdom of the order. Bhante is very much a classical Majjhimika, you know, classical Mahayana. So getting myself bedded down in the order, and it does take time, you know, when you get ordained. You think, oh yeah, when you get ordained, everything's going to be like, oh, great, you know, I'm ordained now. But actually, it does take a while to get sort of bedded down in the order and work out who you are and where you are and what you're going to do and all the rest of it. But getting myself bedded down in the order and beginning to emerge as an individual in the light of practice, it also made me aware of how well the Dharma has been translated into the idiom of Western culture within the order. And this is, you know, largely Sangharakshita's work. One of Sangharakshita's remarkable achievements has been to create a cultural context, or create the cultural context within which an individual can sensibly practice the Buddha's teaching. Because in terms of Western consumer society, it's a bit of a desert, really. When it comes to practicing the spiritual life, it is a bit of a desert. You could say it's even antithetical to the practice of the spiritual life. It's not easy. And what he's done, you know, with the FWBO, is allowed the FWBO to develop into a culture that actually supports the practice of the Dharma. So it's a little subculture within the main culture. The order is well principled because it reflects and embodies the source and root of Buddhism. It's well principled because it reflects and embodies the source and root of Buddhism. The going for refuge to the three jewels of the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. And this provides a basis for the cultivation of ethics, meditation and wisdom. It's that commitment. The order is well founded because our practices derive their inspiration from the Buddha himself, as exemplified historically and mythically in canonical literature, as well as the lives of our teachers. The order is well founded because our system of practices rests on a philosophically integrated basis consistent with the written Dharma, not in contradiction to the Dharma. And the order is well founded because the spirit of enlightenment is reflected in the light of our spiritual community and the network of Kalyanamitrata. Friendship with the beautiful, the lovely, the meritorious, the noble, the auspicious. And is reflected to us from living bodhisattvas, abiding deep within the heart of the Buddhist tradition, and from our own efforts toward enlightenment. So that's what I think about the order. And if you want to discuss it with me, I'll be happy to discuss it with you any time. But yeah, I think the order is well founded. It's very well founded, and its basis is very, very clear. So I'm basically coming to the end of my talk, or the end of this version of my talk. And what sprung to mind was, how do I sum up the order? Well, in a way, the recent retreat at El Convento summed up the order for me. I mean, for me, I thought, well, you know, it's my last opportunity to be on retreat with Sangharakshita. And, you know, this was very important to me. That I was, you know, I went and did this thing. I thought, you know, most of my big spiritual experiences, so-called, you know, in small print, have been either in the company of Sangharakshita on retreat or on solitary retreat. So I thought, well, and also, you know, just to be there. And so I went along to El Convento, and of course Bhante's eyes packed in. So he left the morning before I arrived. I arrived in the afternoon and he left in the morning. And I wasn't actually that disappointed, because I thought, well, it's a sign of the times. You know, that is how things are. That is how the spiritual life is. You know, there's your old teacher, you know, and he is getting a bit old, dottery. And, you know, I might die at any time. And I go to be on retreat with him, and he has to leave because his eyes are packed in it.
So that was all right. There was the building. It was just brilliant being at Il Convento again. Just a beautiful building. You can't describe the ambience. You really have to go there. I'm going to get some photos off Celia Badra so I can show people. But the photos don't communicate a lot. Pesantro was in very good form. I was there for the last 9 or 10 days. Pesantro was in very good form. And one of the things we did, we had pujas at night in this courtyard. It's all held up. The upper floor, the loggia, and the upper floor is held up with these big arches, these big brick pillars, and these arches. And between them, there's a wall about this high. And so it's a big courtyard, you know, and there's the courtyard's about, you know, five times the size of this room. And you can sit, people can sit on the walls and meditate. So we do pujas outside under the stars at night, under these Tuscan skies. We did some great pujas. There was one Vajrasattva puja written by an order member, one of the Dharmas, I can't remember his other name, beautiful puja, very simple, very moving puja to Vajrasattva. And I thought, you know, that's another strength of the order, is all these sort of unheard of order members, you know, just knocks out this puja to Vajrasattva, you know, Dharma who? And it's like, you do this puja and you know, it sort of invokes Vajrasattva in a very meaningful sort of way. So that was, you know, doing the pujas under the stars and then just meeting up with old friends again, guys who'd been ordained for 15 years and talking with them. I mean, to be honest, I'll be quite frank here, I thought, you know, some of the members are mad. And then, you know, some really quite, well, you've got to wonder, you know, whether or not they've sort of cut the candy spiritually. You know, I mean, they're getting on and they need to sort of get on with it. And others, you know, are really getting on with it. You know, some quite quietly. You know, you think, oh, yeah, so-and-so. And you start talking to him, you realise he's been doing all this stuff for the last 15 years. You know, really sort of, you know, solid, you know, effect of going for refuge. And then some, you know, some order members like meteors, you know, they just sort of just stand back and sort of watch the show. There was some of the meditations were so profoundly deep and silent and imbued with some sense that I can't really describe. But yeah, you cannot really do it justice with words. And then another side of it was, you'd be doing a puja at night and there'd be a pause in the chanting and you just drop into this like exquisite silence, you know? And then you could hear somebody talking somewhere in the convent, yeah. Some order members talking in the convent. And at one stage I thought, you know, like, you probably go into the diamond samadhi of the supremely enlightened Buddha. You finally enter into the diamond samadhi. But there's a little noise in the distance. It'd be like two order members sitting down the bottom of it, you know, having a chat, you know, rah, rah, rah. And then there was the study. You know, Vicentra leading the study and everybody sitting around and going to the study, you know, to do with the teacher, a root text to do with the teacher. And it was brilliant, you know, people were like right there, they were up for it, you know. People, you know, really into it. And, you know, Sila Badra was doing the cooking, so there was all this sort of really great food. And then there was a soiree, you know, on the second to last night I had a soiree, and it was brilliant. You know, all the talent in these order members. You know, some of the guys got up and sang, and they're really good singers, and they're singing, you know, some funny little turns or serious songs, and, you know, playing musical instruments and doing various things. And then Dana Vera, you know, he's one of the most energetic people I know in a particular way, got up and did this this act, The Death of William the Conqueror, which is the funniest thing I've seen in the last 5 years. I mean, we were in hysterics. Like he had 30 of us rolling around the place. We were crying with laughter. And he did it all. He has his prop was a hat. He had his hat. That was his prop. And he just, it was brilliant. It went off about half an hour. At the end of it, I remember turning to Vicentra, and Vicentra saying, you know, he could become rich with that one, you know, routine. So there's all this talent in the order. Yeah. And there was the final reporting out. On the final night, the puja on the final night after soiree, we stood around in the courtyard and it was dark and the stars were out. And within the context of this puja, we all just reported out.
You know, some people confessed. Some people just said things. It was mostly a rejoicing in merits and just an appreciation of the order and of each other. And it was really moving. You know, whatever annoyances and irritations had gone down during the retreat, it was as if they were just sort of wiped away. It was pretty moving. And you felt this very, very strong and very deep emotional bond with these guys. And of course, finally, there's the ability of the order just to create such an event. You know, the order created that event. You know, the order rents out Il Convento, all the order members come from all over the world, literally. They come from as far as the opposite side of the planet, you see. Come from all over the world and do this retreat. And, you know, these people bring all their knowledge and talents and everything with them. So, you know, there's these two sides of the order. There's this sort of anarchic side to the order that sort of flows and moves. And there's also this sort of very deep, rich seam of spiritual vitality in the order. And finally, you know, there's the ability of the order to create a spiritual community, which it has done. And, you know, I think it's a spiritual community that reflects the realities of human life. But I remember my daughter, my 23-year-old daughter, saying to me in Melbourne, she wasn't 23 then, but she was just saying about being around the Sangha. She's saying, you know, it's like really refreshing just being around people who are trying to make an effort to be decent, you know, trying to make an effort to behave from the basis of positive emotion. And she really noticed that it was so marked. You know, people not going out of their way to backbite and stab and all the rest of it. And, you know, I mean, I think that's true of the FWP and the order, and I think we shouldn't lose sight of that, actually. So I'm going to finish with a poem of Bhante's. And in this respect, I feel like Cacophonix, the bard from the Asterix comics. He always finishes with poem and he always ends up, you know, tied up in a tree with a gag around his mouth. But anyway, I've spared you from my one poem. And I'm going to read a poem of Sangharakshita's. And it's not a very good poem of his, actually. I don't think it is. But I think what the sentiment it expresses is very good. So which is why I'm going to read it. I don't think he'd mind me saying anything. It's called Sangharakshita's Verses of Acknowledgement, and it's lines written on receiving from a member of the Western Buddhist Order the gift of his record collection, accompanied by some verses. So, though one's food is not perfect, it is enough to maintain health and strength. Though one's house is not perfect, it is enough to shelter the body. Though one's job is not perfect, it is enough to make both ends meet. Though one's wife is not perfect, she is enough to keep the home going. Though one's children are not perfect, they are enough to continue the family name. Though one's morality is not perfect, it is enough to make meditation possible. Though one's meditation is not perfect, it is enough to support flashes of insight. Though one's insight is not perfect, it is enough to reveal the emptiness of mundane existence. Though one's guru is not perfect, he is enough to show one the right path. Though one's fellow disciples are not perfect, they are enough to give moral support. Though one's generosity is not perfect, it is enough to loosen the bonds of attachment. Though one's patience is not perfect, it is enough to put up with having to live in the city. Though one's vigor is not perfect, it is enough for daily practice. Though one's wisdom is not perfect, it is enough not to be fooled by worldly things. Though one's record collection is not perfect, it is enough to make an acceptable offering. Though one's verses are not perfect, they are enough to show one's sincerity. Though one's letters are not perfect, they are enough for keeping in touch. Though one's appearances are not perfect, they are enough for friendly recognition. Though this acknowledgement is not perfect, it is enough to show deep appreciation.